And welcome to Here We Stand, the voice of the Republic of Kanata. This is your regular host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's January the 14th, one day before the 9th anniversary of the founding of our Republic of Kanata. On January 15th, 2015, 51 delegates and over 100 observers gathered in the North Winnipeg Indigenous Community Center and released a statement that said, in part, "We, the sovereign and freeborn men and women of the land known as Canada, as the ultimate and final source of all authority and law, and according to the obligations bestowed on us by necessity and natural law, we hereby sever now and forever all ties and allegiance to the Crown of England, the Government of Canada and its laws, and to the Church of Rome and its agents. We disestablish and nullify their authority over us, and we extinguish any duty or service owed to them. In witness of this proclamation, we therefore establish the Federated Republic of Kanata as a free society on the land under the jurisdiction and authority of the common law and customary land law and according to the will of we the people. We make the solemn proclamation freely and without reservation according to our conscience as free men and women within the natural law." And on that day, we raised our flag over Winnipeg, as is happening tomorrow in a number of different communities across Kanata. Flag raising and also the reclamation of our land, beginning with the reclamation of our lives and the law itself. And that's going to be the topic of the show today, the nuts and bolts of building the Republic of Kanata. I'll be doing an interview with our good brother Owen Lucas, a Republic ally from England, working there in the Republic movement. And Owen was recently released from prison after a campaign to get him out, conducted by us and all our allies around the world, thrown into prison for mentioning certain things on Facebook that the government didn't like. And now he's under a one-year probation where he can't leave certain areas. So targeting us, but we respond collectively, as we're going to be talking about today, how we go about resisting, reclaiming, and replacing the present system. The three R's, not reading, writing, arithmetic, folks. Resist, reclaim, replace. That's our program. And when we established the Republic of Kanata in 2015, many of us were veterans of the campaign to expose and prosecute genocide in Canada. We realized after the February 2013 verdict that found Queen Elizabeth Joseph Ratzinger, so-called Pope and Queen, guilty of crimes against humanity, official authority was disestablished. Not only were these bodies illegitimate historically, they're fraudulent and genocidal, but they were legally disestablished by international law. And so we therefore realized nearly 2 years later, we had to take the step to create the replacement, the Republic of Kanata. You can see the vision of all of that, Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, and that means it's a Algonquin word, meaning where the people sit as one around the council fire. Republicofkanata.org. You can read the program and the vision there. And today, one of the foci of our discussion will be the fact that the way you build a republic is locally, and you do it by first reclaiming the law. And there's a really great quote I wanted to share with you from somebody who tried this in Ireland, in their battle for liberty. His name is Joe McInnes, and he was a veteran of the Republic movement. And in Joe's words, it's in actually quoted in our common law training manual, he says, "Our first real step towards independence from England was the establishment of our own Republican courts, right under the nose of the Brits. We set up a different legal system of our traditional Brehon Irish laws, even while under military occupation. And we had to defend that system and those courts in arms. So you can say that once we started living under our own laws, everything else had to follow right up to becoming a new nation." And that's why the work of our common law courts is so essential. It's creating the building blocks of how people govern themselves through reclaiming the law on their own terms. When you create law on your terms, you've created a new nation. And you can't really have those courts, however, without a legitimate constitutional authority. You have to establish your own jurisdiction. And that's what you hear in court all the time. There's always two basic issues in any court case brought before a court. Who has authority? Who has jurisdiction? Well, without a political jurisdiction where we've separated from the old one and created our own, courts don't have legitimacy. They're de facto under the authority of the old so-called crown regime. And that's why the crown courts are illegitimated by the establishment of our republican courts. And those courts can only be established through the Republic of Canada. For example, when you sign a charter, 12 or more men and women, you form an assembly that can pass laws and act as a court, as well as setting up common law courts. So in other words, this struggle is connected, the political, the legal, the personal, the spiritual. On every front, we are declaring independence from a fraudulent, a criminal, and a genocidal system that's been lawfully convicted and disestablished. The other website to look at, of course, is murderbydecree.com, as well as republicofcanada.org. The two books we'll be referring to today is Establishing Liberty, The Case for Canada, the Vision and Program of the Free Republic in Canada, and Establishing the Reign of Natural Liberty, a Common Law Training Manual, which, by the way, is one of our best-selling book and most well-known. As a matter of fact, people took that book in Australia and out of it have established over 40 common law republic assemblies in that country. It's been translated into 7 different languages, very essential book to get. You can get both of those books on Amazon.com. Just put my name, Kevin Annett, in. Also, you can see them at murderbydecree.com. So for the show today, remember, final point as well, that tomorrow you can join and take the pledge, see that all at republicofcanada.org, and tomorrow go to the communities that are raising the flag and doing the reclamations. You can find out where by writing to us, Republic National Council at protonmail.com. And don't forget, we'll be talking more in future shows, as we've done in the past, with the importance of the November 20th common law verdict in Vancouver that convicted Charles Mountbatten Windsor, so-called King of England, for crimes against humanity and ordering the murder of William Coombs and other Native people in Canada. There'll be more on that in future shows. But for now, learn from the show today, get on board, celebrate the Republic tomorrow on our 9th Independence Day. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. I thank you.
Well, first of all, what we say to people is, if you set out and try to do something as an individual, you'll get nailed. The system likes that because they can make an example of you. Like, some people like to beat their chest and say, look, I'm not paying taxes. I'm not, okay, fine, but you're playing their game when you do that. They're ignoring Sun Tzu's basic maxim, which is you never do what the enemy expects, right? What we do is when we charter an assembly, 12 or more people sign a charter, they become a legislative body that can pass their own laws. They then pass a law saying we're keeping all our tax money in our community. We're setting up a trust fund under the Republic, and we're going to use that money to fund our local society, to fund our projects, to build up our community, to build a grassroots republic, right? That's the first thing we do. And in fact, we've found mayors in small towns have gotten on board with that. They love the idea of not paying federal taxes. Because right. In Canada, and probably in many other countries, over half of the taxes go to pay off debts to foreign banks, the federal tax money. It's not used to help the people at all. If you look at, you know, road building, hospitals, school construction, all of that, that comes from local or regional taxes. It never comes from the federal taxes. You know, so we know at that level that the offshore banks are controlling the tax systems anyway. Canada Revenue is not even a government body. It's a private offshore corporation bearing a government title, right? So that's the thing to keep in mind. First, control the money. And you can't really build a republic unless you start doing that, right?
For sure. And you know, if we're looking at, as we have been in our last discussion, a war situation, you know, the last thing you want to do is buoy up and fuel your enemies by providing them with the fruits of your labor. I mean, it's completely counterproductive to what's going on, right?
Yeah, morally, legally, in every way, we're obligated and we're empowered to just keep the money ourselves. And also, that's a symbol of how we relate to the whole system. We just turn away from it and we just focus on what we need to build as people. Like, I think every time I look at a big protest of thousands of people, I thought, okay, they protest well and then go away. So what's changed? But if every one of those people instead had withdrawn their taxes, not voted, built up their local assembly, started reclaiming the land and the property of these convicted churches and crown authorities, think of the power we could do. You don't even need 1,000, just need a few dozen or a few hundred people doing that. And it would send shockwaves all over the place. But no one's thinking outside the box. No one's thinking, what can I do? It's always asking somebody for help. It's always making a demand, which is like a plea, right? This is all slave language. Please, thank you, clean, appeal. It's all like a slave on his knees asking for something. And even the most militant protest is doing that. Right. Asking for something, right?
In protesting, it's recognizing the authority that's, you know, bushwhacks you, is your phrase, right?
Right.
And so with your Republic of Canada, is there plans or initiatives in the pipeline to begin a new currency without does the Canadian money have the Queen on it?
Yes. It's this funny plastic money.
So then we get to spiritual energetics again, right? Because people want those notes or whatever, and that's fueling the non-physical, you know, interdimensional energetics, right?
Here's the thing: we've got an economic commission looking into the whole aspect of taxes, money, the whole bit. The first thing we've started is local trading and exchange networks to get outside the money system altogether. People pool their knowledge of what they have, their skills. They trade skills in return for food. We've got agricultural communities starting up where we have our own food base, which is essential. Even before money and everything, you're going to be able to feed people. You need a land base in what we're doing. So we're focusing on those local examples that give people the confidence to go to the next step, right? So, you know, you take up citizenship. And that means that you're really in a new jurisdiction. And eventually these questions, you know, are going to be addressed by larger numbers of people. But for now, we're trying to set an example of what people can do to show there is an alternative, really. And that's, you know, a lot of what we do all the time.
Sure. I've very much been thinking about the infrastructure of sustenance and food. There's a lot of problems over here with delivery of food to supermarkets. You know, the supermarkets are very condensed. It's very, very corporate, right? Centralizing everything. And so the idea and the issue of food gardens becomes very important, right? And if there is that locally grown alternative, then it doesn't create, or it removes the dependency on the enemy in the war situation, you know, providing for us, right?
Very much. And I mean, we've known for a long time controlling the seed, pool on the planet, controlling the land base, that's being part of the whole 2030 agenda for a long time. Urbanizing the whole world's population to control them better. I mean, we see it happening all over. It isn't just a conspiracy theory on the internet anymore. It's reality going on. So it makes those steps to build it outside the system all the more essential, right?
Yeah, and there's so much going on. You know, just since we last spoke, I've seen a hat full of citizens, you know, regular members of the public, getting in the face of whether it's headmasters or politicians or, you know, these agencies of the state that need calling to task, and they're putting forwards in very, you know, formal and considered and composed language their rights as citizens. And, you know, we move on to complicity, right? And these, you know, interesting one, I'll perhaps add a clip in of a head teacher being confronted, perhaps is the right word, by a woman who's half the size of this guy. And he's, well, in a roundabout kind of way, defending the location of children being injected. And she's right at him. You know, if you do this, if you allow children to be injected here on your premises, you will face the full force of the law. And this, you know, he won't be, I'm sure, doing the injections himself, but he will be complicit in this crime, right? So getting that down to the law courts and getting into the sequencing of calling in common law courts. Can you give us a definition of complicity?
Well, I mean, you're aiding and abetting any kind of crime. It's you know, people have been taught that the word conspiracy indicates some lunatic in a basement constructing all these theories, right? A conspiracy theorist. But no, it's a term under the law. A conspiracy is three or more people engaged in planning or committing a criminal act and then trying to cover it up. And on that basis, you know, every government, church, corporation in the world is involving in a criminal conspiracy when it's causing that kind of harm. But no, I think the thing that people realize when she said you're going to face the full force of the law, well, no, he won't unless we the people are the law. Because right. The whole legal system now, is, as we know, it doesn't really exist anymore. There is no rule of law anymore.
It was interesting because the head teacher was calling upon, you know, legalities of civil law. And he was saying, this is a school location and you can't film here. You know, there was a guy with a camera. And so he was, you know, calling upon a different set of parameters of legalities. And she was talking about, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean... people say our private club statutes outweigh your basic natural rights. And no, they don't. It's like the Church of Rome. They bring in their little club statutes, their club rules that say you got to protect child rapists. And you have to go along with the rules or you're bounced out, right? So that's, you know, they can do whatever they want, but it goes against inherent liberties and rights in the life of children. So we have every right to defy those regulations and arrest people trying to impose them on us, right? That's just common sense. And there's this big gap between everyone's recognition of that and then acting on it. Because all we can see, I think we mentioned this last time, all we can see is the power of this state. We can't see any of our strengths, right? And that's what we have to turn around by showing people that, no, you don't go through their courts. You have to do the hard job of forming a local assembly, learning the common law, acting in a new way and thinking in a new way consistently, not a 3-minute effort. Your whole life has to be dedicated to this. Your life has to have new priorities. And it's not fitting in. I mean, 99% of the people I deal with are always thinking in terms of, Kev, how can you help me so I can go back to my old life and security? And you can't, right? And you shouldn't anyway, because that security and life was built on the suffering of others, right?
If there's one phrase that I perhaps agree with them over this, you know, this propaganda that's been spewed at us through the media for the last 2 years, it's the new normal, right? There certainly will be a new normal, but hopefully it won't be their version of it. It'll be, a much more healthy and nutritious paradigm shift. And what seemed to be the case with this woman is that that composure that she was emitting, I don't know her circumstances, but I'm seems pretty certain that she was coming from a mandate basis.
When people in Second World War wore stars to show who they were Jews. Now you're
like
discriminating,
to,
and that's
like
illegal.
Would you like me to explain when the students wear masks?
That is illegal, and you'll have repercussions of that as well.
Would
you're
you like me
your
to explain to you
with these
when
jabs,
we wear masks?
Are you quite happy for these kids to be injured?
That there were people with her, one or two, you know, a cell of three, as you mentioned in the last discussion. But it felt like that she was perhaps part of some sort of group, some sort of assembly, and that she was therefore speaking as a representative of a greater, you know, perhaps the parents of that school collectively. And so that composure and that power that she was able to call upon creates that area of enforcement. Right. And you know, they call it canon law, right? Because the cannon fire is the force, right? So there is an aspect of physical muscle that has to come into play when we're looking at lawful rights.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do that when we have sheriff training workshops. We're looking for big guys, right? We're looking for people who can be physically intimidating because that's part of the job, right? But ultimately, law is not about intimidation. It's about seeking common ground, common interest. So, you know, that old saying in English common law, the law does harm to no one. You know, I mean, that's because if it doesn't serve the interests of the people, then what is it? Who is it serving? And that's the first thing you always ask a cop. By what authority are you doing this? Show me the authority. Show me how I agreed to this. But, you know, that when you're raised in a culture that says essentially what they're doing is they're creating a slave society now where you don't even have any basic liberties at all. You just agree and go along or you're dead. You know, we're turning back the clock, not just 1,000 years. We're going back to like ancient Egypt, you know, to a slave society. I mean, that's, and they've got the technology now, they think, to impose that on people. But again, the more a force comes in this direction, we find in history, the more a counterforce builds up over here. And you're seeing that spontaneously happen to people all over the place who are doing what you're talking about, gathering as groups and saying, we are the law now. We have to, because there is no rule of law anymore. They do whatever they want. They rewrite the rules. They expect you to comply without any lawful authority, right?
And then getting into details and sequencing the practical steps, the first step would be, let's take, you know, as we've used this example, three letters to a headmaster, right? There would have to be three recorded delivery letters, and that would be of a claim of right. Is that the same? A claim of right would be the same as a cease and desist notice to be served?
Well, a statement of claim of right is the first step in convening a common law court. Somebody has been injured. You've got to set down who did what to who, give the names, the dates, the details, and say, here's what we want. That's basically what a statement of claim is. Lawyers make it always seem a lot more complicated because that's a bread and butter. But, you know, basically that's what we're doing. We give the people the chance to respond. And if they don't, we can proceed. As a matter of fact, one of the basis on when we talked about earlier, King Charles being lawfully tried and executed as a traitor against the people of England, he refused to answer the charges. It was called a pro confesso. When nobody, like the Queen of England and the Pope, we said, we're accusing you of committing and concealing genocide. They didn't answer. Under English common law, that's a tacit admission of guilt, because if they refuse to defend their good name or counter or silence his consent, they're not challenging what's being said about them. So they're pleading guilty. And in fact, in that situation, it's a win-win, because if the people we charge respond, they recognize the authority of our court, which is great. If they don't respond, they're committing, they're admitting their own guilt, and they're found guilty, and an arrest warrant can be issued immediately. So when we assert our authority, it's a win-win situation. There's an example of that.
I might have mentioned it on one of the previous two discussions, but there's a TV doctor, you know, and I like the way they went for this guy. I thought he was a good target for us, because on the one hand he's part of the journalist team, and on the other hand he's part of the medical team. I went to health, and so there was a clip, you know, again very amateur mobile phone stuff, but they'd sent their three recorded delivery claims of right to him. You cease and desist. You're complicit with this crime against humanity, genocide. Mm-hmm. And the police were present, and you know they were making sure that it seemed that everything was you know, civil, and there wasn't any trouble, in inverted commas, any violence. And the video didn't go any further, but there were a lot of people there as to what would have happened. But you know, he was clearly not, as the king wasn't, playing ball, in inverted commas, with the common law system. So the next step would be then to form a posse, a posse comitatus, right? Would that be the next step? Could you haul in a suspect?
Well, that's two different things. Posse is taken from an old Latin expression, meaning
that's after the verdict, right?
Yeah, all the people in the English shires and the villages, all of the people were empowered by the shire's reeve or sheriff to go out and apprehend somebody being found guilty who is endangering the life of the community or people, right? So every able-bodied man in the village was made a deputy sheriff, part of a posse. Now, you know, that's had kind of a lynch mob connotation in the movies and that, but the point is, a posse is people taking the law into their own hands to protect themselves. But posse comitatus, that's an expression from America, where after the Civil War, when they were trying to reconstruct the South and abolish slavery, the South was fighting back. And so federal troops were authorized to go in and bring in civil rights, to allow blacks the right to vote, to make sure that the slave system wasn't being reimposed. The southern states fought against that and brought in a posse comitatus law, which said the military can never be used to enforce civil law. Right. And everyone thought that was good. But the reason it came about is the slave owners and their descendants didn't want the federal army in there protecting blacks.
How so relevant is that posse with martial law looming? You know, this is so relevant, right?
Right. So it cuts both ways. It can be good or bad. Right. The idea is that now, without any rule of law, any authority can figure in their system can do whatever they want. Right. I mean, you know, they just invent the rules, change the goalposts all the time to suit their own needs.
Right.
It's like I say, a slave system where you got Pharaoh and he's telling everybody what to do, right?
Yeah, they obfuscate everything, kick it into long grass to create the disinterest, right? So going back to that suspect, what would happen? Would the trial would go ahead? There just wouldn't be a defendant because he hasn't turned up, and as you mentioned earlier, that would be a tacit admission of guilt because he hasn't acknowledged the court and we the people and our sovereign right to pull together these courts.
It then proceeds, and the judge often in that situation can issue an immediate, either a bench warrant to arrest the person being accused and bring them into court, or just found an automatic guilty verdict. And then they can go be arrested by a sheriff with a warrant. But in the case of when we tried Ratzinger and Queen Elizabeth in the Brussels Common Law Court in 2012 to 2013, after they didn't respond, the court proceeded, but we kept giving them the opportunity. There was a court-appointed defense lawyer who could speak for them, but we kept saying, look, here's the evidence we're presenting. Do you want to comment? They never did. And so all along, that's them saying under law, we're not disputing what you're saying about us. Therefore, they're guilty, right? They committed genocide, and they're still doing it.
Yeah. So, Trudeau, Tony Blair, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are all these characters that would very likely be found guilty of genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, et cetera, et cetera. Would the Republic of Kanata then be looking to, inverted commas, borrow detention centers that are already established or create their own detention centers for these criminals?
It's a combination. The best case scenario is you deputize existing police and use the existing system under a new jurisdiction. You see, we're not out to fight or overthrow anything, ultimately. We're creating something new over here and asking people to leave the old and join it. And we said that to police. When we were occupying the churches in Vancouver years ago about the genocide, the police would show up and I would hand them a form saying, we're deputizing you as common law sheriffs, because this is a criminal body that you're protecting, the Catholic Church. And if you're not going to help us, then please stand back and don't, obstruct justice, which you do if you tried to stop this protest. They always stood back. They never signed, but they never intervened. We immobilized them by doing that because they know that under our jurisdiction, they can't challenge us, right? So that's exactly what you do. You use the existing system. So yeah, we would deputize, the best case scenario is you deputize the police under the name of the Republic. You go in and seize those buildings and say, this is now under Republic jurisdiction. I mean, it's that simple. That way, why reinvent the wheel? Use what exists, but under a new authority. That's the whole point, right?
Yeah, yeah. Quote from the book here. Common law training, actually just on the book, Kev. There's a few overlaps between this one and the blue one, right?
Yeah, that's the early version. The blue one is the more recent one.
Okay.
The book about the Republic of Kanata itself, which goes into the program and the vision and everything.
Yeah, no, I've got that one too. And so if people are thinking about buying, then it should be either or, right, with this one or the blue one, and perhaps the blue one.
It should be the blue one, actually. That it's more thorough.
Okay.
The blue book, yeah.
Common law courts are established when any number of men or women come together to judge a matter of concern to them and their community. Thus, such courts are invariably and naturally linked to political movements, inverted commas, town hall gatherings, and tribunals of conscience that unite citizens and give direct voice to their concerns and demands. The court is thereby the expression of that voice. The court itself is established by the direct will and vote of the people as a whole, who elect a citizen jury of at least 12 people, a citizen prosecutor, same as the plaintiff, I think, to conduct the case on behalf of the people, a presiding adjudicator, whose job is strictly advisory, and a sheriff and a group of peace officers to enforce the summonses, warrants, and verdicts of the court. And do we mention this a couple of chats ago? But that can rotate, right? There's this week or whatever, we'll have different people in the different roles. Plaintiff is also the prosecutor, right?
Well, that's the ideal. I mean, a court is just convened for a particular case. And so we want to generalize the knowledge so that people, you know, if, for example, somebody's bringing a case about some aspect of the COVID thing, the best person to conduct a case as a citizen prosecutor is the person best informed, who can argue the case, who knows that. They should have a basic understanding of the law, due process, rules of evidence. You know, evidence isn't hearsay. Evidence is somebody who makes a statement has to be able to come into court to validate it with substantiation, a document, another eyewitness, whatever it isn't, which is what you find in smear campaigns. Hey, I heard this about Kevin. You know, did you hear that Kevin, No, none of that is permissible in a court of law. It's all hearsay, right? And so those basic, that basic understanding of the law people need. It isn't just a kangaroo court where we find a way to get somebody, right? Because we never know what the outcome of the verdict is going to be in a common law jury-based system, right?
It seems to me that if you have a really healthy judicial system, lawful system, then the need for politics becomes much less. It seems to me that very much politics is an excuse for a corrupt and defunct legal system. Would you go along with that?
Well, yeah, you see, everything is political. That's the truth. The word politics, the Greek word polis, simply referred to the city. So every citizen of the city was obligated to be part of the political system, to be the judge, to take responsibility for the governing of society. It's the highest calling to a citizen in kind of the Athenian sense, which was direct democracy. It wasn't what we have now. What we have now is a monarchical system out of Europe that said you give authority to somebody with a marked ballot and then they rule over you, right? And that's not what Rousseau said. You know, the best thing for people to read is The Social Contract by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was the philosopher of the French and the American revolutions. And he said, you never have assign away authority to anybody. There are no representatives. You can only represent yourself. You can give a delegate temporary authority, but they have to do what you want them to do. And if they don't, they can be removed immediately. That's the beauty of direct democracy. That's what the American Republic was founded on. But it's the only government that was ever set up on that basis. Every other system works according to elite democracy. I don't even call it democracy. It's the elite know best what to do on your behalf. You ratify their decisions, but they're still in charge, and you have to go along. Rousseau says you never surrender sovereignty. Even when you pay taxes and vote, you never surrender sovereignty. You can step out of their system whenever you like, right?
It's that constant centralization, right? That corporatization, turning things into a corporate structure, a hierarchy, where eventually, you know, it becomes one emperor. You know, whether that's a CEO or a judge in a court. And when you look at how the legal system works now in all our countries, they're trying to dispense with juries, right? They're trying to create secret courts. Nothing could be more greater testimony to the defunct corruption of these courts and the fact that they're not public, and the fact that there's no jury any longer, and you know, children are being trafficked via these courts, and you know, there's not even a jury to decide.
It's worse than people understand. Like, it's even years ago, a friend of mine was arrested in Chicago because he went into a Catholic church and gave him a copy of my book and said, "You should read this." The priest freaks out, calls the police. The police immediately arrest the man for handing a book to a priest. And he's given a summons to appear. He walks into a room and there's a camera on him and says, "How do you plead?" And he says, "Who are you? Who am I speaking to?" And he said, "Answer the question. How do you plead?" And he goes, "I'm talking to a machine. This is not due process. I want to see a judge." Boom, you're guilty. He's got to do either 6 months in jail or community service. For doing what? For handing a book to somebody? I mean, but this is how, and that passes as a court now. You know, I've had a lot of stories of that kind of people. Under COVID, they ramped it up even more. Now the courts are closed. You've got to appear. And some of our people who were arrested in Ontario went through exactly that. They had to plead in front of a camera. And we told them, don't, just ignore it. You know, we're ignoring this because it's not due process. And then, you know, you just boycott their system. That's the only way to relate to tyranny, right?
It's interesting that they've had the legal system, the courts in their back pocket for so long that it's created so much complacency in terms of, you know, what they're attempting in in a criminal fashion. And that complacency is I feel they're undoing currently, that the platform is collapsing underneath them as the people begin to haul in and recreate the structure and the platform of, you know, ancient common law jurisdictions, assemblies.
It's innate within us. We already understand this, but people don't trust their own feelings, their intuitive understanding that we do not have to comply. It's that simple. And I say no, right?
Right, completely. Enforcement. The big and thorny issue, of course, is not whether men and women can come to a court verdict, but rather how their decision can be enforced and effective in their community. This is especially an issue when the verdict is imposed against heads of church or state or even entire institutions, as in the February 25th, 2013 verdict of the International Common Law Court of Justice, ICLCJ, concerning genocide in Canada, see www.itccs.org. To use that, actually, that website's no longer active. Right?
Yeah, it was taken down.
It's Murder by Decree Archives, right?
Yeah, murderbydecree.com under ITCCS Archives has all that material.
Okay, yeah. It's important to clear that up. To use that case as an example, the moral weight of the verdict was clearly the strongest weapon in the arsenal of the court and created the conditions for the enforcement of the verdict against the 30 officials of church and state named in the indictment. So that 30, Kev, are the dirty 30, right? They're known as the dirty 30. So there's a citizen's arrest warrant out for all 30 of them. Are we now at a point where we can, you know, go get them?
We always have been.
Can we entice, you know, big, strong, strapping guys that there would be, you know, these are very rich institutions and individuals. I'm thinking of the Wild West wanted signs. You know, you get the reward, right?
We've actually created a few of those posters with Ratzinger and Liz Windsor's face on them. But no, but the point is we have arrested them already. They've arrested themselves.
Right.
Joseph Ratzinger has not left the Vatican in 8 years because he knows that, you see, a citizen's tribunal like what we set up, its verdicts and the evidence that the verdict was based on, it's all actionable by other courts. So any court in the world can issue an arrest warrant based on the docket of evidence we presented on our sentence and our verdict of guilt, right? So they know that, even if a lot of people don't know that. And so, you know, these people tend to avoid exposure for that reason because they know how vulnerable they are. But it you know, and ultimately what is enforcement about? It's about changing things. It isn't about just grabbing one person and locking them up, you know, that kind of retributive justice. I know among Indigenous people who I've worked with, they don't have any notion of that in their tribal legal systems. They don't believe in punishment. They believe in rehabilitation, if you like. So, for example, if you've wronged somebody, that person then has to go work with the family they wronged and change. It's not about, you know, punishing someone because jails don't ever cure anyone. They just make them worse, as we all know, right? But a private, you know, for-profit jail system needs people in jail, right? They need crime. They need all of that. So that's the system that's ultimately, again, it's what kind of political and economic system do you have that reflects your system of justice, right?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of money. You know, prisoners are commodities, right? As these corporations traffic humans, you know.
Well, in America, you know, the 13th Amendment, as they always hold up as the great thing that abolished slavery that Lincoln brought in 1865. If you read the actual quote, it says, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States." So in other words, they said you can have slavery in prisons, that anyone who's convicted of a crime is still a slave under the law. That's why you've got more people now in prison than there were slaves. 9 million Americans in prison. They have no rights. They're slaves under the law, right?
I heard that the slavery thing was, there was a con job where rather than emancipate and free the blacks, that they just enslaved everybody in the detail of the legalities of it. Is that correct?
Well, what came out of slavery was the whole industrial system. You know, the big industrial giants, the robber barons, came out of the Civil War because of the huge war industries that were created. The big steel industries, Carnegie, Mellon, Rockefeller, all those guys, you know, they came out of the Civil War conflict. And they didn't like the idea of abolishing slavery because I remember one of them saying, if we tell the slaves they're free, then our workers are going to want to be free too from wage slavery, right? And so they had to create the system just like, why do you keep a queen around or a king? Well, to make people feel they're subservient. Why do you have a pope? To make them think there's somebody in charge. Otherwise, the people would rule themselves and they wouldn't need us parasites on their back, right? So, I mean, it's all psychological when you think about it, political and psychological. How does a few rule the many, right? That's always the issue.
Yeah, I mean, you know, comprehensive education is all about teaching people in their earliest formative years, like right. Pavlov's dog with a bell, to defer and offload and obey an authority figure, you know, exactly like you would an emperor or a pope or whatever it is, right? It's just really entrenching at an early age.
My daughter Eleanor, when she was little, she'd always say, why daddy, why? I'd say something and I explained to her, but you know, often parents get uptight. You're not supposed to ask why, just do it, right? It starts in the family, you know.
We have been taught wrongly that taking the law into our own hands is a violation of civil order and tantamount to anarchy, whereas for citizens to judge legal matters for themselves is the highest civic virtue and the cornerstone of true democracy, according to Athenian lawmaker Solon. The latter even believed that citizens should be fined or reprimanded for shirking from a public controversy or from their inborn capacity to be lawgivers. At the heart of that personal responsibility for the law is the capacity of citizens to judge a lawsuit for themselves as sworn jurors and impose a verdict and sentence in such a suit. The jury system has always been the purest expression of the common law, and its capacity to empower the people themselves to defend traditional liberties and ascertain the truth of a matter. And as we're in this realm of psychology now, you know, we're talking about that training Pavlov's dog from our earliest interactions with the state and with authority. This is a real you know, cutting the cords, if you like, that people feel abandoned almost to get out of that umbrella of responsibility. You know, to defer responsibility is quite an easy way out rather than to take a stand and to be part of a lawful jurisdiction. It takes so much autonomy and sovereignty, right? It's a big step up for people.
Well, that's why people are kept working at dumb jobs that occupy their life. They're kept in that state of near poverty, so they have to be struggling to survive all the time, and they don't have time. They're so tired at the end of the day, they just want to collapse in front of the idiot box, and they don't want to think about these things. And it's set up that way, right? People are exhausted, and living in this world, being mortal, it's filled with fears and uncertainties, right? And so it's safer. People are always inclined to find what's safe to give them the illusion that they're going to protect themselves. And ultimately, like I say, at funerals or with people on deathbeds, you can't protect yourself. We're all going to die. We have a death sentence called mortality. The question is, how are you going to live during the time given to you, right? And not how do I shore up that which can't be shored up, which is your own mortal life. Think instead about what I need to leave for my children. What kind of world are we going to leave, right? And then you're empowered beyond your means, right?
For sure, for sure. And again, back to practicalities, Kev. Could we do a Zoom court case? Could we have common law trials via the internet? Is that something that could be practical?
Yep. We encourage local courts. We encourage the people to have face-to-face direct contact, just like in an assembly, because you've got to know the people you're working with. It's the best. But, for example, with our common law court in Brussels, that found the Dirty 30 guilty, convicted them. That was done by Skype, 57 citizen jurors in 9 different countries around the world were linked that way, right? These days when you're doing those
to confirm courts, a jury of 57?
We had 57 jurors. There were, at one point, over 100 volunteers, but we had to we had a jury selection system. We offered, you know, the defendants the chance to come and help pick the jury, and of course they ignored it. So that took a while, but there were a lot of volunteers. They were thirsty for that knowledge. They wanted to see the evidence about these people, right? And there was lots of it based partly on the work I'd done in Canada for many years. But the funny thing here, Owen, is that the evidence is incontrovertible. You can't deny it once you look at it. And that's why they have to bury it. That's why 90% of the stuff we put out there over the years is now gone off the internet. It's a process of continually recreating, reminding people of what we achieved, right? I mean, I'm looking at a pile of 19 of my books right here on the table, right? And it's like, how much of that is in the school system? It's not allowed in. Murder by decree vanishes from the library and from the schools every time we get it in somewhere, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And I had just a little anecdote about that. The same incident occurred in New Zealand and in a place actually called Owen Sound, Ontario. Some of our people went and asked to order my book, Murder by Decree. And both librarians said the same thing. After checking, they declined and they said, we can't order that book. It's on a list. Okay, a prescribed books and banned books in New Zealand and Canada both. Well, that's a pretty far reach. It means that the Commonwealth has a policy, Kevin Anna's books cannot go into public libraries, right? I mean, and on the internet, it's even easier to censor and befuddle people. So, I mean, that's what you're up against. And yet it's a sign of how effective we've been that they have to do that, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a real a symbol of fear, right? And just the flip side of that, you know, I don't know if you have in North America this kid's character called Peppa Pig. Well, there's a Peppa Pig takes the vaccine book, though. So they're there. So you know, right down at the earliest formative years, they're promoting their themes, and yet, you know, really important ancient common law principles are being digitally burned, right? Burning of the digital books.
But I mean, burning books back 500 years ago didn't work. We always find a way around these things, you know.
Yeah, I feel it's coming to a healthy crescendo now. A guy I met while I was in Swansea prison, he was telling me that around the Swansea area here in South Wales, there's 70,000 dads locally that have, I think they've got a Facebook group, but they have some sort of gel with 70,000 of them. And I was thinking, wow, that's a real powerful mandate of people there. And that would be both a locational theme, but also a theme that is tied together with a similar coherent topic in terms of parental alienation and abuses by the family law courts. Would you suggest from your experience that locations are the best way to start assemblies if people are thinking, watching this and thinking about initiating a common law assembly?
Yes.
Or more so than themes such as parental alienation or...
Oh, well, okay. So there has to be both you need to help people on the specific issues, especially parental alienation, because frankly, it's one of the ways so many people are controlled. What might happen to my children? That's how they control many people. And that fear and degrading the role of the father is part of that, because traditionally in many indigenous cultures, the male was the shaman, the protector, the one who would go on the spiritual visions to protect his people. You have to be aware of what's happening around you. You've got to be a protector and a provider. That's tradition. That's not sexism. It's biology. I mean, and if you take away that role, then the whole family system is fraught. The women, the children can be grabbed. I mean, it's a whole plan to pit man against woman, husband against wife, right? And so you need to campaign on those specific issues. But the thing that really unites people is if they know in their neighborhood there's an alternative. We got our Swansea Assembly happening this Monday. You should come and check it out. You know, we're going to pass our own laws. We're not obligated to the system anymore. We don't even worry about what London's doing. We are establishing self-governance. And, you know, Wales, there's a long tradition of independence, the whole, you know, Cymru independence movement and that. And I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can mobilize people in that. But people have short-term commitments. They not just because their lives are busy in that, but because they think things can be fixed quickly and they can't. You know, it takes years of effort and struggle, but the payoff at the end is we want our liberty, we want our lives back, and there's no greater cause to fight for, especially when it involves our children.
So that physical gathering, whether that's in a town hall or a public building, and on the topic of buildings, these court buildings are public buildings, right? We pay for these courts out of our taxes.
Absolutely.
We can take them over. We can use these courtrooms, right?
Absolutely, and we should use them. There was that famous case in Birkenhead near Liverpool years ago where 600 people went in and arrested the judge and took over the court. And that got swabbed out of Facebook quick and YouTube. But, I mean, the point is people just did it. And they were led by a very educated, strong group of people who knew the common law and had their own sheriffs. They were very organized. And you got to operate off the radar a lot till you're organized. If you announce yourself too soon, you get taken out, like what happened on the West Coast of Canada, 9 of our assemblies, just wiped out in a month, all of them, because we had gone public too quickly. You need a core educated, organized, and adept to the tricks of the enemy, which is why last week's discussion was so important about the whistleblower manual, how you navigate around their tactics, right? But so you need to build those local assemblies and courts, but on the basis of knowledge and, a core leadership.
There was a more recent one that I've seen, the Birkenhead footage that you mentioned. And a couple of weeks ago, there was really interesting footage, and it didn't last long on the internet. It was down pretty quick. But these guys went to a high court, and the judge was out of there like a rat in a drain pipe.
Oh, I know. These guys run. That's the funny thing. It's like priests, when you go to a Catholic church, they often just run out the back door. They're cowards, and they know they're guilty, right?
Yeah, you know, we've spoken about it in the last couple of discussions, but that illusion, that facade of what they're trying to present is utter BS, right?
Yeah, and don't forget, authority rests on legitimacy, and it's a mental construct. I mean, authority is all up here. And I remember this priceless example I had of that. One of the times we were occupying the church, the police showed up. And because most of us were native, they felt they were free to start getting rough with us. So this one guy came up to a young woman, a native woman, and said, you got to leave. And she said, why? Who are you? And the cop said, don't you know who I am? And the Indian woman just looked at him and said, you're just a guy in a blue suit. And the guy kind of did a double take, and it was almost like he was thinking, yeah, I guess I am just a guy in a suit. Like she blew away with the fiction. And there was just a man standing there in front of her. And once we do that, we've taken away their power. And we've got to get to the point where people do that automatically, and then they have no authority left. We do now, right?
100%. This quote, so much talk, you know, increasingly, seemingly about us being in a war, you know, globally. And I really feel, I think about it a lot this week, as after we spoke about it last week, that the more that rhetoric is out there, the ratio of public to corrupt goons is so in our favor that if people are discussing whether or not this is a war situation, then that means that they are alive and awake to the situation. And it seems, you know, a very healthy conversation to have because yeah. it's sways the numbers, the statistics so much in our favor if sides are drawn in that fashion. So this is Joe McInnes, who was a Republican veteran of the Irish Civil War and in 1974. And during a war situation, he's talking about fixing up these courts as a priority, right? Yep. Our first real step towards independence from England was the establishment of our own Republican courts. Right under the nose of the Brits, we set up a different legal system of our traditional Brehon laws, even while under military occupation, and we had to defend that system in arms. So you can say that once we started living under our own laws, everything else had to follow, right up to becoming a new nation.
Right, and that's key. There's a brilliant scene about that. I don't know if you've ever seen the film The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
I watched it about 3 weeks ago.
It's so beautiful. But do you remember the scene? They're sitting in a bill. They've convened one of those courts, and they're sentencing a local landlord.
Yeah.
And they're the court, right? and they saw themselves as the court. They didn't just say, oh, we're a bunch of guys sitting here in the room, how can we be a court? They believed, they knew in their heart and mind that we were a new court of a new nation in birth, right? And once we get into that state of mind, miracles can happen. It's going to open up. And that term, the wind that shakes the barley, it was a metaphor for the Republican movement, saying we're like the seed. When the wind blows the seed, it scatters all over the country, and they can't control the growth, right? And so it's a very kind of spiritual awareness of that, you know, we're seeking that higher place from which to act in keeping with the law of nature, right?
Right. Law is that seed, right, for the birth of pastures new, right?
Yeah.
We're at the arrow mark, Kev. Shall we call it quits there? I think
it's good. I just urge people to read those books and the Republic of Canada. We go into detail a lot of how we see the Republic, how we see a new society. So it's all related to everything we're talking about.
And is it fueled? Is there a greater momentum behind the Republic of Kanata because of this COVID nonsense madness?
Oh, yeah. I would say after the COVID measures started, our support increased 20-fold. That's a new number, new citizens. It just shot exponentially. Now, it tapered off and went down, and it goes in waves all the time. People fall away, new people come in, but it's a movement that can't be stopped now. It's all over the place. And it has allies all over the world, you know, in America, of course, because a lot of people are innately get this from their own republic traditions, but all over the common law world, the Commonwealth countries, we talk all the time. In Australia, they built a tremendous movement based on my book. This guy, Mike Holt, 3 years ago, got my book. He started meeting with people. They've got like easily 40 to 50 assemblies and local common law courts now all over the country. And they're challenging local authorities all the time. It's really fantastic. So again, there goes the barley, this barley seeds fertilizing all over the earth. That's what we're doing, right? It's bigger now than we ever could have imagined, right? Republicofcanada.ca, it kind of documents some of it there.
Yeah, it's education, right? People are enlightened to the potential and possibilities because of, you know, these books and these conversations and these movements. And so people, you know, they have reason and common sense, and they look at one and they compare it to the other and they say, yeah, this is the society and the world I want to live in, as right. opposed to the one we're leaving behind, that old world of you know.
It's all about choice. We all have choice, right? And that's what I found in healing circles when survivors of these deadly crimes in the church schools, native schools, at the point at which a woman put it, I mentioned this last time, she said, I used to be a victim, now I'm a threat.
Yeah.
It's because she realized I have a choice. It doesn't matter what's happened in my life, I always can choose how I'm going to react, what I'm going to do next. And when you recover that, you know, you can become unbeatable. And that's what we found, right?
Right. Yeah. Many thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Chat again soon.
Cheers.
All the very best. Cheers. Take care.
Yeah. Okay.